What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond 80Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond 80Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Pleasure to have you here. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Very good.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you have been listening for a while, welcome back also. Hopefully, if you're a James Bond fan, you'll learn something new from this podcast. You may have heard it all before, but maybe you'll just enjoy hearing three idiots blathering on about it.
Dulcet tones.
So this is a special episode, another special episode following last week's about Cubby Broccoli. This one's about Barbara Broccoli, Cubby's daughter, and the main co-producer of the James Bond films from GoldenEye onwards, I guess. How have you found digging into Barbara Broccoli's life?
I'm not going to lie. It's probably, from all of the research we've done so far, this is probably the trickiest one. And we've just done Cubby, and that was really easy to find stuff out about. So the difference between the two is pretty high.
Yeah, it's a very stark difference. Such
Why
a
do you
contrast.
Think that is?
Well, I mean, we've spoken about this before, where she's obviously part of a big family, a big film, famous family, and there was probably an element of protection that came from Cubby and the family in making sure that she wasn't constantly, you know, hounded by the press and people, because I imagine there was a lot of people trying to get hold of her just to find out about Bond from a young age. So there's definitely an element of that, I imagine.
She's definitely lived a very private life, that's for sure. But as the head of one of the biggest film franchises, there is plenty of information out there, I guess. But I guess
it's quite select, isn't it? There's you find pockets of quite in-depth information around something quite specific, but there's not a treasure trove of articles and interviews dating back a long way that you do find with some of the other people that we've researched.
Yeah. Well, I thought a quote that I found about her I thought was quite telling. It's, I don't think I ever knew a time before James Bond, as far back as I can remember, Bond has been a huge part of my life.
Yeah. 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 I found that one as well. And it's a pretty, you could imagine, can't you? I mean, from when she was a kid. That family was one of the biggest families in the film business by a certain point. And I read some interesting articles about how she, like the whole of the British film industry, they were all like a big family. So Michael Caine and people, all these actors, they were just friends. They were just around each other's houses. They were just working together. So being brought up not only with the Bond world around you, but every other big cinematic kind of event and all the famous people working around them, it's got to have a big effect on you.
Yeah, worth mentioning that she's co-producer with Michael G. Wilson, who is her half-brother, and he has a similar connection, I guess, in that his whole adult life has been defined by the James Bond films. And that's really interesting. I think that sort of as we talked about last week with Cubby, that sort of family run business sort of atmosphere. Yeah. It's so crucial to the longevity of the series.
Oh, completely. And we might speak about it, we might not, but the children of Barbara and Michael G. Wilson, not together, they're already filmmakers. They're already script writers. I think the two sons of Michael G. Wilson have worked on previous Bond films as well. So you can see where it's going, which is quite exciting in a way. We'll talk about that a bit more, I imagine, with the towards the end of the podcast.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning, as we should do. That was the pre-title sequence. Now we're about to strap on the parachute.
Just jumping out the door with a parachute on.
And that parachute will take us back to 1960, when Barbara Dana Broccoli was born. What did you learn about her early life, Brendan?
It's very, you know, few and far between. But what I did learn, she was born in LA and grew up in London, but also grew up on sets of Bond, because even from when she was a toddler, she was on the set of the first Bond film, Dr. No. So straight from the beginning, she's there, you know, immersed within Bond. She was even present on the scene where Ursula Andress comes out of the water. She was there with her mum. So right from the very start, and one of her earliest memories actually involves being sick on a remote Japanese island during the filming of You Only Live Twice in 1967.
So, hang on, earliest memory, age 7?
This is what she says. This is her earliest memory.
That's quite late, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Quite a memorable memory then.
But it's a memorable one, because she was in Japan. She travelled there with her father, Cubby, and while they were shooting You Only Live Twice, yeah, she got ill, and there were no Western beds in on set or anywhere there, apart from Sean Connery's, because he had one shipped over. And so he'd found out that she was ill, and he offered to sleep on the floor and gave her the bed.
What a gentleman.
Yeah. She actually said, "I got very sick. My parents thought I had sleeping sickness. The only thing to sleep on were traditional bed mats, no Western beds. The only Western bed had been shipped in for Sean Connery by production. And he went to my mother and said, 'Look, you have a sick child. Take my bed.' So I actually slept in Sean Connery's bed, which I'm very happy to say." So that's a pretty impressive first memory to have, to be honest.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed that he's the only one that could command a bed.
Yeah, I know, like even Cubby.
Well, that was You Only Live Twice, wasn't it? That was around the time where they were saying, "What do you want? What do you need?
Anything.
A bed?
Have it.
Yeah, you can have a bed.
Donald Pleasant, just get some straw to sleep on."
So school holidays, she would spend at Pinewood and on location where they would be shooting Bond. So and that's, you know, that's pretty much how her childhood was spent, really. And her family, like we touched upon, they kept her shielded from all the sort of press and all the fame that comes with Bond. And they did a good job, because there's very little to go on. But she
I was
did...
actually wondering when we were researching, if a lot of the obviously we're doing a lot of research in books that we can find and on the internet, but I'm wondering if there were old magazines or things that ever had interviews that just haven't, we can't find now.
Yeah, because they've not been.
Certainly seems
digitized.
To be a big grey area of that world where it just wasn't mentioned.
Well, maybe one of our listeners has an archive, and they can enlighten us a bit
please
more.
Please do.
Yeah. I suppose those earlier years, though, before the GoldenEye kind of era anyway, it would have been Cubby that got all the attention about the Bond films, and he would have been doing all of those kind of interviews, because she wasn't the producer at that point. So, there's definite gaps in there.
So she grew up in a household where Bond was just talked about and referenced so much that she actually thought he was a real person until she was 7. She said, "I thought
like
James Bond
Santa
was...
Claus."
Yeah, exactly. Oh, very much so, isn't it? That's around this similar sort of age. She said, "I thought James Bond was a real person until I was 7 or 8. He was always talked about, so I didn't think of him as a fictional character."
I wonder if that was before or after she slept in his bed.
Yeah, she thought it was James Bond's bed. And then age 17, she went to study motion picture and television communications at Loyola Marymount University in the US. And then from that point on, once she'd studied that, she joined E.ON and went to work for them at Pinewood. So that's where her proper Bond story then begins.
Well, yes. So I'll take on from there. As you can imagine, her first Bond film that she is properly credited as having a job in was The Spy Who Loved Me when she was 17. But unlike most people who their first job is in the industry at a certain age, I imagine that she was still on set involved in stuff before then. So it's probably a very different first role that you might have to a normal everyday person who's just got a job in the film industry. She's obviously, well, obviously you've got the added point that could be the most powerful man on the set is her dad as well. So yeah. It was probably an interesting role. She worked in the publicity department of The Spy Who Loved Me, which she actually talks about as saying it was a really important part of her learnings of the whole Bond series. And as she became producer, what she learned during that was actually quite important because she understood what everyone did as opposed to just coming in as a producer to a film later on and really just understanding what producers do. She worked with all people across the various departments to do probably some, at the age of 17, she was probably doing some quite easy jobs and menial jobs that made her understand what it was like for those people. So it's a skill that she took on and the learnings that she developed as she became a producer and then applied them to, you know, working with the team. And I'll talk about this later, but she's meant to be very good at creating a working environment that is really enjoyable and people like being there, which I think is quite an important aspect of it. And when it's a family business and when you've grown up with it, it's probably more inclined to being like that because you are working with these people for a long time. And as we know from a lot of the other podcasts that we've done, some of these people that she's working with, they would have looked after her when she was a kid because they've been on there so long. I read an interesting article with her and Saltzman's daughter, it's Hillary. And they were talking, I think he was saying that Morris Binder taught her driving lessons and also dressed up as Santa Claus at Christmas. So you can see that, imagine like Morris Binder doing those things for you. That's just a normal scenario for you. So obviously being so close to these people that it does create that kind of environment that has quite a big family environment. But really, there's not a lot to say about that role. It's not a big position within the company, so she wasn't really delivering anything that people were talking about at the time. There's not really any interviews where she talks about it in too much detail. So yeah, that was just her first step into the real world of working in Bond. Then obviously she moved on to bigger roles in the following films.
Yeah, well, if we email to E.ON and ask her about these roles that she had in her earlier films,
we definitely
films
need to. Yeah,
yeah.
I think people would.
We'll redo the podcast once we've spoken to Barbara.
So she has got a bunch of credits after The Spy Who Loved Me before she became a proper producer on the film with the Timothy Dalton era. The first of which is 1979's Moonraker, on which she has, according to sources, a second assistant director role, which is uncredited on the credits. Now, second assistant director, anyone know? Want to hazard a guess at what that does?
Absolutely no idea.
No. So according to Wikipedia, the font of all knowledge, the second assistant director creates the daily call sheets from the production schedule in cooperation with the production coordinator. They also serve as the backstage manager, working with actors, putting cast through makeup and wardrobe, which then relieves the first assistant director of the duties. And then they also supervise a third assistant director trainees, and also the setting of background extras. So it's a multi-task job.
Yeah. Well, you can see straight away learning quite a lot about how the industry works quite early on.
Yeah,
those are really interesting roles to deal with.
You've definitely got your finger in a lot of different pies there, haven't you, in the production, you know, makeup, production schedules, all this sort of stuff. It's all invaluable learning, I imagine, for her on the set. Now, the next one I'm not really sure about, but For Your Eyes Only, apparently she had a role on that film. I've not been able to find any evidence of what that might have been, and I'm only able to get that information from the James Bond Encyclopedia, which, you know, is a really great resource, and I trust it because it's from the Eon archives, but I can't give you any more information about what she did on For Your Eyes Only. Then we've got Octopussy, and she's credited as executive assistant on that. This is quite an interesting one, actually. On Octopus, she also apparently did an uncredited gig as assistant director. So again, it was all that sort of behind-the-scene management sort of stuff. But this is an executive assistant position. So as we've talked about before, Octopussy, there was a lot of umming and ahhing with Roger about whether he was going to make this film or not. And when he was not, they hired a casting director called Jane Jenkins. She's a US-based casting director. And they flew her over to the UK, and under the cover of that she was here in the UK to cast an actor to play a James Bond type. But obviously she was casting for Bond. Now, Barbara acted as Jenkins' assistant. I'm doing that in air quotes. But actually she was in charge of the whole situation. So she would sit with Jane, who was the casting director, but ultimately, you know, she had as much say as Jane in the decision making. And according to the source that I read, she would ask, you know, she would play up to him and be like, "Oh, can I get you another cup of tea, Miss Jenkins?" And so really played the part of Jane's assistant, but really she was pulling the strings there. And then her next film, A View to a Kill, obviously we talked about that in great detail very recently. And if you recall, one of her tasks on that was to ferry Grace Jones every morning to the studio and to the shoots. Yeah. And
that crops up in a lot of kind of historical records. I think Roger talks about it in his book.
So this sort of assistant director, assistant producer role is very sort of, it's a very hands-on job actually. And so it's all just a learning curve, right? And it's from that transition from Roger to Timothy Dalton, I think, that she makes her step up.
Yeah. Again, if anyone's got more detail on what I'm going to say, then great, let us know. Because she then became an associate producer on these two, the two Dalton films, with Tom Pevsner. So this is where you start to see the transition. Because Cubby's getting older, of course, and she's given more responsibility. She's involved in the casting as well of the Bond. She was very much impressed with Sam Neill.
Yes.
And yeah, that's who she wanted to use. So this is much more involved in everything, really, overseeing a number of things. But trawling the archives, there's no more, she doesn't really talk about this, which is surprising because this is the first big leap, isn't it, really? But there's not really much on it. But there is a quote I found. "I grew up around Bond my whole life, and it was such an integral part of my life. I had the benefit of working with my father for so many years. I learned so much from him and how to make movies and James Bond. His passion for it was extraordinary and very contagious." So that's why this, you know, this journey has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got an inevitability about it at this stage now. So she's,
yeah, it's getting serious now, isn't it?
Yeah. She does the two Daltons, and then and Cubby's getting towards the end of his life, and you can see, yeah, they're going to look for someone to take over.
Mm-hmm. So although she was there for Dalton coming on board, reading about how he came into it, he sort of fell into it, right? Because they thought they had Brosnan, and then he got pulled
because of Remington Steele. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, you got to wonder who was making that decision, how much of Barbara that was taking on Dalton. Yeah. But it's really when we get to Pierce Brosnan, I think. Brosnan then inherited it from Dalton because he was falling into it. It's really when we get to Daniel Craig that we really start to see the decision making at play. But you've got to wonder, again, it'd be a great question to ask her, you know, how involved she was in that process at that point.
Absolutely. Because now they're very close friends now. So obviously the relationship, it went well from that point on. So maybe she was involved, but we can only speculate, sadly.
Well, that leads us on to probably, I think, for me, the biggest shift that Bond has probably ever had until the Craig era, which is Brosnan and moving into the 90s. And a lot of factors change this, obviously. in the run-up to GoldenEye, Cubby obviously started getting ill. There's quite a lot that, in fact, we didn't cover about Cubby's illness and over the period of GoldenEye and how it happened. But his illness and his kind of frailty over that period did mean that he took a back seat in the making of GoldenEye, and that's when Barbara and Michael stepped up. Now, I'm not sure if there was a sense that they were going to step up anyway, or if it was a result of this. I think I've read various accounts of it, and it does sound like it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think that at that point, Cubby must have been thinking they need to start taking the reins now. There's a new Bond. He was quite old by this point. They needed to do it. So I think there's probably an element of both factors, but it did force the hand slightly.
Yeah, and there was obviously all the turmoil between those two films, right? Between License to Kill and GoldenEye.
Yes. So there was a six-year gap between License to Kill being released and GoldenEye being released. And that was because of the whole problem with MGM merger with Pathé. And that just went on for quite a while. And it obviously had a massive impact. I won't go into the details of that problem because it's not really to do with Barbara, but that did have a massive repercussions for the Brosnan era, because there were 6 years passed between that last film and the new film. So big changes, and those big changes had ramifications across the whole of the next bit of the series, because obviously that 6 year gap was a big problem for Bond, because License to Kill didn't do very well at the cinema. It wasn't a ridiculously successful Bond film. You might have been able to save it if you'd released a film quite shortly after that did well, because that's how Bond works. There's fluctuations in it. But 6 years was the longest time that there'd ever been between Bond films. And I remember at that time thinking, would there ever be another Bond film? It was quite a shock when GoldenEye came out to see it, because it felt like it'd been an age between Bond films. And
at our age, I think it felt like there hadn't been a Bond film, because I don't remember the Dalton films coming out.
Well, we'd only ever seen them on video.
Yeah.
I agree. Like, it was the first Bond, because...
Yeah,
I was born in 86, so obviously I was too young for the Dalton ones.
Yeah,
and then you get to 95, you're like, oh, what's this? This is exciting.
Yeah,
the perfect.
Yeah, it was almost like
teenager.
People had forgotten. Yeah. For us, it was like, oh, Bond, that's that film that the old films I watched with Dad. It's not.
Yeah,
they brought him back. It was like a massive renaissance for Bond, wasn't it? And it was it was very exciting. But also, Barbara talks about this quite a lot, in that. There was a lot going on at the time. There was obviously everything happening with Cubby's frailty and getting older, but they just did what they knew what to do best. They just made the film as best they could, and they didn't know if it was going to work, but obviously it did. And it proved to the world that people still wanted Bond, and Bond could develop as time went on. It was, and I remember thinking that at the time, they've done it. They've managed to create a new Bond that still feels like Bond. So other things happened at that time. Richard Maybaum and John Glenn, they left the series. Broccoli parted ways with them. Massive shift. Suddenly you're losing the old guard, and there's you're bringing in new directors and all this kind of stuff. And Cubby was interested in bringing new people to the series, including Barbara and Michael. And that, obviously, that's the first time that they've really held that. If you look at any of the documentation, that's the big point where they become important within that series. And that's where they start doing interviews, and that's where they start really speaking about Bond and the future of Bond. Robert Wade, who co-wrote a number of the Bond films, he says that they just, as a pair, they worked unbelievably well together. Barbara is very much concerned with the emotional side of the story as well as the relevance of it now, whereas Michael, he's got a very good story brain and has a macabre dimension that allows us to keep the Ian Fleming flavour of the thing. And that's, if you think about it, Michael J. Wilson was heavily involved in a few of the films before then, but this is really when Barbara gets involved. And you can see that side of what Michael's doing in the earlier ones, but you can't see anything of what Barbara's doing, really. And that comes into much bigger play over the later ones, especially the Craig era, where that emotional side becomes very, very prominent.
Well, it becomes the supertext, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you can kind of see little touches of it in Dalton's, but not only just. And it's not very... You'll see as we go through that it becomes quite more significantly more important as it moves along. Interesting, another point between the GoldenEye, the shift, is that the Cold War era had also finished. And that was that the wars and that Cold War, you know, the last couple of decades, was that underpinned a lot of Bond films. General Golgol and everyone were always in it. It was like the basis of Bond. If there, the Russia was like the unseen baddie in so much of it. Even when it wasn't Russia meant to be the baddie, Russia was always in there as some kind of like floating presence, and that gone. And that shift has a lot of noticeable effects on the film. In fact, there's the point where you see Cold War statues toppling in GoldenEye. And there's obviously a lot of Russia in GoldenEye, but it's almost like saying we don't need this anymore, we're going to move on from this.
Well, there's that line from M, isn't there, about calling Bond a relic of the Cold War.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought M up, because that's probably the most important thing Barbara did for quite a long time. It was her decision to cast Judi Dench in the role of M, which is probably one of the biggest things that's ever happened in any of the Bond films. It's a massive, important male character has been turned to a female character. It also happened 2 years after Stella Rimington became Director General of MI5 in 1993. So you can see Barbara is on trend. She's moving with the times, and she's taking these things that maybe if she hadn't been, you know, joined the helm of this, that might not have happened. And it has repercussions throughout the whole, massive repercussions into the Craig era. If that hadn't happened in the Craig era, the films would be very different indeed. So yeah, so there's a lot going on at the time, and obviously it turned out pretty good.
Yeah,
they were pretty pleased with GoldenEye. They'd shown that it, you know, Bond was still there, and suddenly it opened up this whole new series for Bond in the 90s. But thinking about it, and I'll go through the other films briefly in a minute, it's quite a difficult time, and I think that, as we talk about Craig later, that era was when they really took over, because there were still a lot of things that were happening that were as a result of the previous films. Cubby still was floating up. Cubby had set up GoldenEye. Cubby had been so heavily involved in that. It was still a Cubby film. They hadn't made all of the major decisions on it. They were still, you know, they were still assisting the guy who owned it all. And a lot of those decisions that happened on GoldenEye probably had repercussions later on. I mean, BMW, I'm not sure who made that deal, but that lasted for three films. There's certain things that happened over the 90s which might have been fallback from the previous eras of Bond, and it wasn't for a while until they could shake those and really make a difference. Tomorrow Never Dies, interestingly, I didn't realise this, Tomorrow Never Dies, that apparently they were writing the script for Tomorrow Never Dies while they were writing the script for GoldenEye, because they, you know, they take so long to do these things that they wanted to get a head start. And I don't know if that's a common thing. I've certainly never heard it before, but I suppose if it's a Bond film, you're kind of expected to go, we're probably going to make another one of these. Let's get it started.
If you read Mark Edlitz's book about the lost James Bonds, there's the times where the two scripts are working side by side, and often they'll have competing scripts and competing ideas, and then they'll just go with the stronger one. But that's interesting. They were working on it at the same time. I guess they'd had that 6-year gap, and they really wanted to hit the ground running when they could.
Mm. Yeah. But that just goes to show you that there's still fallout from previous. Like, they're writing the script probably when Cubby was there. Cubby probably sourced Tomorrow Never Dies scripts and was putting input into them. So, and then just another interesting point about that: John Barry was in talks to return to the Bond films, but for the first time in a decade, but they couldn't reach an agreement over his fee. So it was Barbara who chose David Arnold to score Tomorrow Never Dies on recommendation from Barry. So pretty big, another big decision that obviously plays into the Craig era. And then the other thing with Tomorrow Never Dies as well is that there was a massive jump in the production budget. GoldenEye was pretty small. It was
a cheap Bond film, wasn't it?
Yeah. So GoldenEye was 60 million. And then Tomorrow Never Dies goes up to 110 million, which obviously off the success of GoldenEye. And you can see that in Tomorrow Never Dies. There's a lot more in it. There's a lot more action. There's a lot of big scenes. And then onto The World's Not Enough. Interesting point that about Barbara in that is that in November 1977, a month prior to the release of Tomorrow Never Dies, Barbara Broccoli watched a news report on Nightline about the world's major oil companies vying for control of untapped oil reserves in the Caspian Sea. And it was this that sparked the idea, really, for The World's Not Enough. And yeah, that's Barbara seeing something that's happening and wanting to take hold of it. And of course, it works really well. I think it's one of the stronger, definitely from a story point of view, that's probably one of the stronger films that is in that Brosnan era.
Yeah, very memorable, isn't it? It's a clear hook, isn't it, for that film?
Yeah, and then going on to the actual film itself, I think World Is Enough is really the time when Barbara comes into play. I think that's the first film, and I think Tomorrow Never Dies probably had hang-ups from GoldenEye and the time before, but World Is Not Enough, it was almost wasn't like those two films. It was very different. They got Michael Apted in to do the directing we've spoken about. So very emotional film.
Bond.
Yeah, very original. Very emotional Bond. Very. There's a lot of depth to it. Obviously, and I'll talk about this in a bit as well, Barbara Buckley is very focused on equality and workplaces and focusing on women in the industry and the storytelling of how to do female characters. And obviously World's Not Enough, that's a big one for that, and we talk about that as well, where it's the first Bond film to really have a strong female villain in a role that is actually a very tangible good character. It's not a caricature, it's not stupid, there's a twist in it about her that's really quite impressive throughout the film.
Spoilers.
So it's the first. Sorry.
Spoilers.
Well, yeah, I'm guessing most people listening to this might have watched it, but if they haven't, I'll keep that quiet. But yeah, that film really is a high point, I think, for storytelling in the Brosnan era, and has echoes that goes into the Craig era based on the kind of depth of it and how the storytelling and characterization is done. Which then takes me on to Die Another Day. So Die Another Day was obviously the end of the Brosnan era. And the way that the world was working and the way that the industry was working, it was a massive action film. They pushed the bar in any way they could to the point of doing really quite over-the-top things. And it was... It did very well at the cinema. At the time, it was the highest grossing Bond film that there had been. But afterwards, there's a lot of interviews about the shift, because obviously Daniel Craig era is where all of the interviews, all of the documentaries are really about, that you find where Barbara is quite vocal and talks about it quite a lot. So there's a lot of talk about how it did get too ridiculous, and Barbara said this in interviews, and that they needed to bring it back to earth. But the other reason as well was 9/11, which had a big impact on their decisions to change that as well, because after 9/11 it seemed inappropriate to make light of Bond's ambition to save the world. It had to be serious, because you couldn't just make a stupid throwaway film where there were terrorists and doing these things. So obviously that moves on to the development later on. But just before we move on to Daniel Craig, The World's Not Enough is probably the time where I spoke a bit about Barbara on set and how she creates this atmosphere for kind of safety and for women. And there was an interesting, Rosamund Pike spoken about this, and she talks about how on Die Another Day, which was her first brush with Hollywood, I look back over my experience and think, my goodness, Barbara Broccoli was way ahead of all this Me Too movement. There wasn't an ounce of feeling uncomfortable while I was on that set. And I can imagine that, and I don't know if this is true, but the films in, you know, 1960s, 1970s, there's got to be a lot of, you know, male domination around that time. There can't have been a particularly gender relaxation period for women. Having her involved in those films, she's picked up on this, and she's spoken to all the teams. She knew all of the cast and the crew. She probably understood this, and it's pretty big deal that, you know, Cubby had a daughter that to get involved in that and really take those steps forward.
You read those Roger Moore diaries, and it talks about the photographers who would come to set to take basically photos of the background extras, the female background extras, for like photo shoots and what have you, and like topless photos. Like if you look through the archives, like on Thunderballs, the online James Bond photo archive, there's like just like topless photos of the background extras, and that sort of stuff was rife back in those days. Not going to happen now, especially not in the Me Too era.
But even in the 90s and the late 80s, that would probably still happening, that kind of thing. It wasn't until, you know, 2000s where it's really been a focus. But it sounds like Barbara was ahead of that. She kind of helped pave the way for that in a lot of ways, which, you know, you'd expect from somebody who's worked in the industry and seen all of the problems that exist in it. And yeah, massive testament.
And had the power to make that change. That's the most important thing.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, a lot of people say that she is the most powerful woman in the movie industry, which, yeah, probably is, in terms of the films that she does and the people she has an effect on. As well as that, probably worth mentioning that she did try to get the Jinx film made. Do you remember this one?
Yeah.
Never actually did happen. Apparently, MGM got cold feet about it after the film's £80 million budget was suggested. So that never actually got off the ground.
So that's the Halle Berry spin-off from Die Another Day, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk. And when you read, and I'll talk about a little bit about this in a bit as well, but when you read a lot about Barbara and the film she's making, there's so many articles about, is there going to be a female Bond? When's the female Bond? And she's very adamant that Bond is a man, and women shouldn't take second place, and you shouldn't build a character, or just take a character that you've already got that's a man and turn it into a woman, because that's unfair to women. It's they should have their own strong characters. Maybe Jinx was a way to do that, an early attempt at doing that. But yeah, never got off the ground, and I think I'm quite pleased that didn't happen. And just to finish on the Brosnan era, there was a lot of during the transition. Obviously, Brosnan was in the news quite a lot, and really, he talks a bit about how it ended. And apparently, it was just a phone call, a very simple, quick phone call. Barbara was crying on the phone. Michael, very stoic, just says, "You were a great James Bond. Thank you very much." And in response, Brosnan just says, "Thank you very much. Goodbye." And that's it. That's the end of the Brosnan era, which I think is quite nice and clear. I think it's probably...
I don't know, because he was due to make a fifth film. It was announced that he was making a fifth film. But I think there was just a confluence of circumstances that meant that they pulled the plug. We'll cover that in much more detail when we talk about Brosnan, which is coming up very soon, actually. A special episode of Pierce Brosnan. Just be Brendan talking for 90 minutes. Might be able to get a word in edgeways.
Intro.
But yeah, we'll talk a lot about that. But yeah, I think there's definitely a case that says, you know, the classic era of Bond ends in 1989 and a whole new era. There's a line in the sand, isn't there? License to Kill is the old era. GoldenEye is and that forward is the whole new era. And that's defined by Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that the 90s era, the Brosnan era, is actually a little bit of a cursed era, really, because it is that transitional phase. And there's certain points of it where it is quite jumpy. The elements of the storyline, they're not as consistent as you would expect from, like, the Sean Connery ones. There's a very consistent style and there's a very consistent ethos that goes through the characters and everything. Whereas the Brosnan one, it's very jumpy. And if you compare GoldenEye to Die Another Day or World's Not Enough to GoldenEye... all very different films. He always plays a different Bond in the later ones to the first one, especially Die Another Day. But
I think it's probably a lot to do with the four different directors that they hired in that era.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of it was a weird time. Yeah. Again, we'll talk about that more when we get to Brosnan. Yeah. But I guess yes. Yeah.
So the big one. Let's move on to Craig.
Yes, yeah, so we are now entering the Daniel Craig era, and as you mentioned, Jinx, I think, after Die Another Day, was a big project that Barbara was really trying to get off the ground, and it got really far down the path until it got the plug got pulled on that by MGM. Halle Berry recently has said that she thinks it's because the studio thought that female-led action films and with a woman of colour would be struggle at the box office, which is quite interesting. But yeah, so really it's at this point that Barbara and Michael G. Wilson face their sort of sternest challenge yet, right, in recasting Bond. As I said before, you know, they inherited pretty much Dalton and Brosnan as hangovers from the Cubby era, and now this was the chance to really forge their own path. And at the time, I mean, you can remember as well as I, it was such a bizarre casting. It seemed a bizarre casting at the time.
Yeah, I watched that scene yesterday of him. Is he on like a boat or something? He's got his long hair.
Yeah.
and people are, there's like people complaining in the newspaper the next day about it.
Because he'd been wearing a life vest.
Yeah.
He does look like if you're used to Bond and you're a fan of Bond, as soon as you saw that, you were like, "What the hell? What's going on?"
Yeah. And you know, they were working with Martin Campbell, who was very closely worked with them. Obviously, he did GoldenEye. Now he's coming back to do Casino Royale, and they worked very closely with Martin Campbell to recast. And he was not convinced by Daniel Craig, Martin Campbell, but Barbara and Michael say they only ever wanted Daniel Craig. And obviously at this time, you know, Henry Cavill was in the mix, Sam Worthington was in the mix, a bunch of different people, but they really, you know, they saw Daniel and that's who they wanted. Quote from Barbara said, "He brought flesh and blood to the character. Bond in the novel is a silhouette, but Daniel has given him depth and an inner life. We were looking for a 21st century hero, and that's what he delivered. He bleeds, he cries, he's very contemporary." And that just says everything about, you know, the Daniel Craig era, doesn't it, I guess? They were working from Casino Royale, the holy grail for them, really. It had been the holy grail for Eon for such a long time. And it was only through working with Sony on releasing these films that they were been able to get the rights back to those films, to that film. And so they were really taking it back, and they wanted.
Well, what did Barbara always say about that? Cubby said to her, "If you never need to get back to it, go back to Fleming.
Go back to Fleming. Yeah, always go back to Fleming." Yeah. And what's interesting though is how actually Cypher like. Bond is in Casino Royale. He's the least fleshed out you'll see it, Bond, but he does go on a great journey with Vesper, and I think that was the thing that they were really clinging on to, right, is the relationship with Vesper and how they could really present Bond as a sort of a proto-Bond. You know, he was wasn't fully formed. He was going to fall in love. He was very green behind the ears. No, wet behind the ears. Green
gills?
I'm trying to say. Green gilled, yeah. No.
Yeah. All of them.
And this is another quote from Barbara. It says, "One of the things about Daniel is that he's let us into Bond's inner life. We see and feel him from a much more intimate place. In the books, you can look into his inner conflicts and fears and anxieties, but it's very hard to put that on screen without making him look neurotic." And I think, you know, that's what Dalton was trying to do and perhaps didn't quite meet it.
He didn't have the backing, did he, of everyone else? No. He was trying to do something that he wasn't really allowed to do. And
ahead of the time.
Craig's
probably.
Ahead of his time, It wasn't really his fault. But yeah, Craig, he's got the support of everyone to do it.
Yeah.
Must have been quite a nice role to have.
And so they talk about, you know, how the relationship with Vesper and his betrayal by her becomes like the crux of his whole era, really. And so finding him as a, you know, thinking back, you know, I think the only thing I'd ever seen in him was Layer Cake by the time I'd seen him. And he's great in that film. Mm-hmm. He's got a real presence, and they must have seen that in him. But looking back, you know, it felt like a weird decision at the time, but such a great one that they made.
It was inspired though, wasn't it? It was such a smart move to ignore the public.
Yeah.
And because the public do just, they want more of the same, don't they? But slightly different. They didn't do that. They made it very different. And it was what it needed. And it was, it's an inspired show. It was a massive gamble, but really, really worked.
And I even remember, like, for a long time, people would say, oh, you know, Pierce Brosnan, he'll never be as good as Pierce Brosnan. Even after Casino Royale came out, it was like there was still talk about Pierce Brosnan being their Bond. Yeah. And it seems silly now, but I guess that's just
there's
the cycle
website,
of it, isn't
wasn't
it?
There as well? Blonde Bond.
Yeah.
Not Blonde Bond.
No, but CraigNotBond.com.
CraigNotBond, yeah.
It's true though, isn't it? You look at, this is why the Bond series is different, because if you look at any other film series that has different directors, different writers all the time, and there's no real ethos or family ethos behind it, the actor is so important, because if you get the wrong actor in those films, the only reason you go and watch those films is for the actor. Whereas Bond is just part of it, isn't it? It's really as long as Broccoli's are there, it's still got that same ethos, and you can kind of trust it. So like when the next Bond comes out, the mentality, the guy might be too tall or it might be too short or something. But I think you're probably working with the principle that you kind of have to trust that Barbara and Michael G. Wilson know what they're doing. and that they're going to take the right risk, because they don't want it to go wrong. They'll have done so much work to choose these people.
I think the most important thing about Daniel Craig is he makes Bond feel like a real person, and that also comes across in how they, you know, script the films and how they plot the films. It's very, very grounded in terms of what can happen, and you feel him when he gets hurt. You know that comes across. You feel it for him.
The big thud.
Emotionally and physically. But yeah, talking about the backlash, Barbara said, it's absurd. I think that's the trouble with the internet now. Everyone has an equal voice. So people read something they believe has been written with great authority, and actually it's just a 12-year-old in a little town somewhere in some place in the United States. They'd never even seen Daniel Craig. They don't know what he's capable of. And it just, this backlash starts a fire, and then people start talking about it, and it's given prominence, and it just becomes bizarre.
Yeah.
And so she says, of course, we were making the film and we knew what we had, so we just ignored it, you know. And then obviously the proof was in the pudding with Casino Royale, right?
Absolutely.
But you can see there's films made nowadays that are essentially made by social committee. People listen to what, you know, social media is saying and the feedback, and then their film's created off the back of it. Quite often doesn't work, because really you it's the creators that need to push the boundaries and make something new. You can't just do what people want, because people want what they know.
Well, that's it. And that's something to, you know, compare with Star Wars and those sequels, the recent ones, whether you like them or not, they are films that are made by committee. Force Awakens very much, you know, just mind the nostalgia, and you can't really aim that at Casino Royale. Yes, it has nostalgia. Yes, it puts the DB5 in there, but it's trying something new. It genuinely is trying something new.
I get a feeling that Die Another Day feels a little bit like made by committee, just throwing in invisible cars and stuff that people have suggested, investors have said we need these new things in. But but obviously that's, you know, Casino Royale is almost the opposite of that.
And then, you know, from there we've got, had Quantum of Solace, a film hamstrung by the writer's strike. And then Skyfall, a huge triumph, I think. Personally, I think it's the best of the Craig films. And then Spectre, which we'll get to that when we get to S, but I think had its problems, had its own problems, in a sense. So under Barbara's stewardship, they've had, you know, a pretty good run. And I think it's secured the future, right? People are talking about Bond more than ever, right? And that's because of the work they've done.
It's incredible. And you look at the gross of those films, they just go up every year. Yeah. And look at Skyfall, it's absolutely phenomenal. As soon as you see that, you think, well, there's no way Bond's going anywhere.
No, you couldn't even contemplate
them. You can't have said that in earlier films.
Not making another one, could you? You couldn't imagine them saying that. That's just...
No.
Yeah, so it's an incredible job they've done. I mean, and look right now where we're at with No Time to Die being delayed. People are desperate for it. People really want it. Like,
well, look at the effect it had when they pulled it from November, the release schedule from November. Obviously they delayed it nearly a whole year, but it was that final delay from November to this year that really pulled the plug on the whole of rest of last year's cinema slate. Yeah. It's crazy.
I
was actually, when I heard that, I was surprised at how powerful Bond is, because I often think of Bond, because I've always been a fan, I often see it as not niche, but there's a certain group of people that love Bond, and that's how it's always been. But it's not. It's one of the biggest films for everyone nowadays. People who don't even care about Bond, really, they want to see that film.
And I think that was the risk, wasn't it, going into this new era, was that it would just be, you know, for the older fans. But it's a four-quadrant movie now. You know, the older and the younger both like it in equal amounts, really. And that's down to Daniel Craig and this sort of new mythos that they've set up for him.
Yeah.
But it does put an incredible amount of pressure on the next move.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we should probably do a whole episode on what we think should happen in as it develops, because that's a whole world of where they could go and stuff like that. Yeah. But
we know from what Barbara has said is, you know, he can be any colour, he can be he can come from anywhere, but he will always be a man. So we know that. I think they will go for a diverse Bond, and I think it's about time. I think that's absolutely going to happen with the next one.
I think with Bond and the Broccolis, that kind of move towards diversity, obviously there's a big push in all industries, in all jobs to do that. But I think the Broccolis will only do that if it's the right thing.
Yeah.
And if it's the right person for the job. So I kind of like that sentiment. But it could be that it doesn't happen for a while.
Where in the past they will have only looked for the Bond type, right? I think now they probably feel emboldened to be able to expand their horizon a bit more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to see what they do next. So obviously Barbara is renowned for her work in the Bond films, but it's not the only films that she produced. And also not the only medium she works in.
Well, she did TV and stage work, didn't she?
Yeah, so she's done work outside of Bond, like you say. When her father died in 1996, she worked with theatre producer Michael Rose to create the stage musical version of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So we mentioned Chitty Chitty Bang Bang again. Gets another mention on the podcast. So she wanted to put this on in the West End. She rehired the original songwriters, who were the Sherman Brothers, who wrote five new songs, and it debuted in 2002, and it was huge. It's and back to her father's sort of motto of everything or nothing, she threw money at this stage version of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. The flying car itself cost £750,000. Bear in mind, it doesn't actually fly. So that is it's a Guinness World Record in terms of a prop for it, as you would imagine, you know, the most expensive prop. The complete set cost £6.2 million, which is the most expensive in British history. It beat Cats, knocked Cats off the top, which was £6 million. So she's, and I guess this is where you see where, like you say, with The World Is Not Enough, she wanted to put emotion into it. This resonates because she's big on the theatre and putting plays on and musicals. So she did a stage play of Chariots of Fire as well. So she says, "The film had such an impact on me in 1981. I was very good friends with Dodie Fayed, who was keen to get involved in filmmaking. So I ended up helping him become an executive producer on the project." So that's where her links with Chariots of Fire started. And then she co-produced the stage play with the director, Hugh Hudson. He directed the 1981 film, and they worked on that together. So she produced the 2012 play. She's done quite a long list of plays that she's been involved in. La Cava, A Steady Rain. If you've seen any of these, jump in, by the way.
I had a look earlier. I definitely haven't seen any of these.
No. Catwalk Confidential, Once, Strangers on a Train, Love Letters, Othello. No.
Keep them coming.
Kid Stays in the Picture, The Country Girls. So it's quite extensive. So it's not just Bond, although she's known for Bond. She has got other stuff going on, including an independent production company called Astoria Productions. Astoria was where her father lived and was brought up. So I'm guessing that's not confirmed, but I've just put two and two together there and hopefully made four. And she helped produce Crime of the Century for HBO. So she's also involved in some TV work as well. But in terms of non-Bond films with Eon...
Well, let me explain. Interestingly, if you look at like Cubby's filmography, he started in the industry before Bond existed. So he did quite a few films that weren't Bond. He kind of moved around and probably learnt that he wanted to do Bond-style films.
Yeah.
Barbara, obviously, being part of the Broccoli family, has only really known Bond. So there's not really a lot of other films that she's actually done. There's two main ones that she's really focused on, and they're both quite interesting from what we know of Barbara now after running through this podcast. They're quite interesting from a number of angles. The first that I'm going to talk about is a film called Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool. Have you heard of this one?
Yes. Yeah, Jamie Bell.
Jamie Bell. That's in 2017. I didn't know a lot about this, but I sat watching trailers and reading about it, and now I do really want to see it. It sounds really interesting. It's a biographical romantic drama directed by Paul McGuigan. So the film itself stars Annette Bening and Jamie Bell, and it's got Vanessa Redgrave and Julia Walters in the cast, so some pretty big names in that film. It's based on the memoir of Peter Turner, who was an actor, a young actor in the 70s, and he met Gloria Graham. And I don't know if you know anything about Gloria Graham. She's an old 1940s and 50s actress. You probably, the only film you probably know her in is It's a Wonderful Life. She did a lot of films, but she's one of the main characters in that. Very, very good character in that, in fact. So anyway, in the 1970s, the film is set in the 1970s, and Gloria Graham meets Peter Turner. It's a real story. This really did happen. And they had a relationship. He was a young guy, played by Jenny Bell. She was in her 50s. I won't get too much detail about the film. So she got ill, though, during the relationship with Jamie Bell's character. And I think it was stomach cancer that she eventually suffered from. And the story covers that and how a relationship developed. And he moves to America to live with her. And she doesn't tell him that she's got this disease. And he doesn't know what's happening. So it's quite a deep and quite emotional film, as you would imagine from Barbara.
Of course.
And I try to find out why she did it, because normally there's a reason why people do these films, especially if you're only really associated with one series. Why would you pick a film that seemingly has nothing to do with the Bond series or of your history? And really, it just seems that it's a film that was just floating around for years and years. I think in one interview she says that she's been wanting to make it for 22 years. And apparently she knew Gloria Graham, and I think, I'm not sure, that she also knew Peter Turner as well. And so it's obviously a personal project for her, and she wanted to make this story because she was quite close to it. And really interesting concept. The film was a box office flop, so it grossed $4 million against a production budget of $10 million, but it received quite good reviews, so people think it's quite a good film. It just didn't do very well. So yeah, that's the first big film that she did, which is a move away from the Bond series. The second film she did was in 2020. Now, this is more interesting in the Bond world, and based on what we know about Barbara and what she's been trying to do with Bond. It's a 2020 action thriller that's directed by Reed Morano. I don't know a lot about Reed Morano, but her biggest credit is she's the first woman in history to win both the Emmy and the Directors Guild Award for directing a drama series in the same year.
Handmaid's Tale.
She did the pilot episode of The Handmaid's Tale, and I think a couple of other episodes of it. So the film is...
you haven't said what it's called yet.
Oh, no. The Rhythm Section. The Rhythm Section. The plot is very familiar, but in not in the way that you'd probably expect. Blake Lively plays a character called Stephanie Patrick, who is a woman who's lost her entire family in a plane crash, causing her to develop a drug addiction and become a prostitute to support her habit. But then she finds out the crash was staged, so she eventually tries to find out who caused the crash, and she trains under a former spy, learning combat, intelligence gathering, disguise skills, and then takes the identity of a freelance assassin, Petra Reuter. Jude Law plays Ian Boyd, who's the former MI6 operative who now lives in a cabin and trains her to take on this mission and find out who actually did it. So, yeah, you can see there's links, isn't there, to Bond. Mm-hmm. And we've talked before about Barbara wanting to create these roles for women and not giving them the Bond role, but creating these new ones. And obviously, in a lot of the discussions and interviews that took place, that's a focus of them. Is this a new Bond character that you're creating, a new franchise? She doesn't really talk about that. She doesn't really say that was the plan when they were doing this, but obviously there are links to that. On Rotten Tomatoes, it gets an average rating of 28% based on 172 reviews, not very many, an average rating of 4.74. In Peter De Bruges, who was writing about the film in Variety, noted that Stephanie, unlike the female assassin protagonists in films like Atomic Blonde, Red Sparrow and La Femme Nikita, displayed a realistic near incompetence in the face of danger that makes her relatable in ways that very few cinematic assassins have ever been. Which, if that's what the aim was, it's a pretty good job from Barbara. And not, you can imagine quite easily to make these, if you were going to do a film like Jinx, those films sound quite familiar, don't they? Atomic Blonde, Red Sparrow, La Femme Nikita. And she probably, I don't know if it had an effect, but that whole time of trying to make Jinx must have had an effect on the films that came later. So who knows if that was why she made the film, but there's definitely links to Bond in there and the storyline. So that's it, really. That's what they're the two films that kind of sit outside of the whole Bond canon.
Yeah, interesting. Michael G. Wilson worked on those films as well, I believe.
Yes, he did. He's not credited on IMDb, but he did.
Yeah, so I guess that's sort of Barbara Broccoli. Just a few things just to note. She was made an OBE in 2008, and she spent a lot of time mentoring young directors, apparently, because obviously Bond films only come along every so often. She must have a lot of time to do a lot of other philanthropic work. But she said that, "I despair because women certainly have their voice in so many other areas. I don't know why it's been so difficult to get women in the industry, into the industry in terms of directing film." So Rhythm Section, obviously directed by a female director. And I think we'll see, you know, likely that we'll get a female director on Bond very soon as well.
Yeah. There's a lot of articles where that's a focus, and that would be very exciting to see what happened with that.
Yeah, definitely. And in 2016, Barbara was appointed BAFTA's Vice President for Film. A few things that she said. Well, so this is a quote from Daniel Craig, actually. This was when he was talking about coming back, I think, for Spectre or No Time to Die. He says, "Barbara doesn't take no for an answer," says Daniel Craig. "It's not in her wheelhouse. I had a nice long break, which I really needed. And then she was just persistent and came to me with some ideas, which we started formulating. And I got excited again." I guess that's interesting to note as well, that now Daniel Craig acts as a producer on these films as well. The first Bond actor to act as a producer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And again, that just speaks of her collaborative nature, I think.
Yeah. Certainly feels like there's a different style to how the films are made now, which, I mean, that, you find that on a lot of kind of way films are made now. There's a very different way to the olden days of those set formats and who's involved. But yeah, it certainly sounds like she makes a nice working environment and people want to work with her.
But yeah, I love the, hearing them talk about Daniel Craig when they're talking about Bond. They don't entertain the notion of there being a next Bond.
No. Yeah. I've got a quote from her, which she said post No Time to Die. "I'm in total denial. I've accepted what Daniel has said, but I'm still in denial. It's too traumatic for me." She's not accepting it, is she?
Well, no. there's that, but then also I think you've got to back your own horse, haven't you? And I think when you start talking about the next one and you've still got a film to come out, I think that becomes like counterintuitive.
Well, Craig is basically her Connery, isn't he?
That's true. Yeah.
She created Craig. She created this fairly important character in the annals of Bond. And I imagine that it was the same scenario when they got rid of Sean. Mm-hmm. It must have been, they didn't want to let him go, did they?
Well, he didn't go, did he? He came back.
Well, I came back, yeah. Maybe that'll happen with Craig.
Yeah, who's going to be the Lazenby?
I'd love there to be a new Lazenby. And I was telling you this, Butler, that I think Bond needs a shake-up. I think it needs a one-hit character that comes in and you go, he wasn't right. And then in 10 years' time, because the way we talk about Lazenby now is such an interesting part of the Bond story that, yeah, it's just exciting to see those characters come in.
Just that one-off one, yeah. I guess the only time I think you could see that happening is if they did do a period set Bond.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it'll be if they do something that doesn't work, that it just only works for one go.
Yeah, that they could just do a complete one-off, which would be really interesting, I think, but unlikely, I think. I think they need to keep Bond moving forward with the times to keep him relevant, I guess.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to say on Barbara?
I've read quite an interesting bit that sums up quite nicely her view on films, and I think it ties in quite nicely with how the Bond team and family do these things. You know how they plan ahead so far. They're not looking for an actor to be in the next film. That's so far from their mind. That's what a normal director would do who's making a film, and that's it. They'll make a film, they'll get an actor in. She says, "When you're dealing with a franchise, you have to think in long term, because most movies are about one movie. My father always used to say, in terms of studios and this and that, temporary people making permanent decisions, you can't put your hands in them. You have to decide what you think is right. It could be wrong what you decide, but make it your decision. I think we both learned a lot from our dads and got that strength and conviction from them." And that's quite a nice whole sentiment about planning. It's all about the relationships you build with these people. You can't upset cast and things like that, and you've got to build these kind of characters that can last a while. They're probably looking at, you know, they're looking at the Bond actor who's going to take on the next films in 15 years time or whatever. Mm-hmm. They must be way ahead with these, and that makes such a massive difference. If it'd be really difficult for her and could be and people to work on other films because of that. They're not thinking like a normal director or a producer. They're thinking, oh, I've got to make this ready for 2030. This arc's got to finish then, which is such an alien way to plan these things, I imagine. I don't know how companies would even respond to that. They're not thinking in those terms, are they? They're thinking, right, we've got two films coming out. We want these to make this much money. And she's saying, and that's why the casting is so important. When Craig came in, they were saying, get another Brosnan in, because that's made a load of money. We want another person like Brosnan to do that. And she's saying, I'm going to change it. I'm going to make someone a new Bond. And they're going, no, that made money. This might not make money. But she's playing the long game. And I think it's a big testament to doing that production role on Bond.
Well, yeah, and that comes from Cubby as well, I guess. He was very single-minded in what he wanted. We'll talk about maybe more in Casino Royale or Daniel Craig episode, but there's a lot of stories around Barbara and how insistent she was to get Daniel in the role and how she clashed with Sony studio executives and all this sort of stuff. It's a fascinating story, and we'll get into that in other episodes. But
well, it makes you wonder what could have happened if Cubby wasn't here earlier on. Would Sam Neill be Bond or whatever? If she could actually have made those decisions, but yeah, would have been a very different story
for sure.
I suppose the only other thing to mention as well, and we talked about it in the intro, is it's a family business, and the children of Barbara and Michael G. Wilson are in the film industry now. The two sons of Michael G. Wilson have both worked as in production in some form in previous films, and Angelica Zollo, who is Barbara Broccoli's daughter, is a film director as well. So I think it's going to be very exciting to see, you know, a new generation of these coming through, and hopefully we're still around when these films are being developed and made, and these guys are taking on the family mantle, because they're definitely doing the research and the work to learn how to do it now.
Yeah,
I guess it will all tie in with what happens next with MGM, I guess, and what the situation is there. Is this the time that the family cashes out? I hope not. I really hope not.
Yeah,
it would be a shame, wouldn't it? It would be a major. I mean, you don't know what'll happen, but it's definitely going to lose that ethos, that family ethos. Yeah.
Well, should we wrap things up there?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think we've covered Barbara Broccoli pretty well.
She's definitely one for the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yes.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. We've been your hosts, Tom Butler,
Brendan Duffy,
Tom Wheatley.
And yeah, if you want to email the show, you can get us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk. Where else can you find us, chaps?
Instagram, Twitter.
Yeah, so Instagram and Twitter and Facebook.
Bondatoz.
James Bond A to Z.
James Bondatoz.
James Bondatoz, yeah. So anything you want to let us know, if we've got anything wrong about Barbara, if you want to set us up with an interview with Barbara so we can learn about her doing
If you are Barbara.
If you are Barbara.
If you want to speak to us.
Please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks for listening. Join us again when James Bond will return in the James Bond A to Z podcast.
I like that. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.